Welcome to Law and Disorder. Today we're going in-depth on tort reform with Steve Peskin and Shoshana Bookson.
By tort reform, that's what the Bush administration calls it. What it really means is we can't sue the bad guys anymore. Pharmaceutical companies, insurance companies, and others are literally going to get away with murder.
We'll talk to Avi Cover about Alberto Gonzalez.
Alberto Gonzalez, who proves the theorem that the more you torture, the higher up you go in the administration.
Michael Avery will join us. He's a former president of the National Lawyers Guild to talk about the national security state and what we can expect in the years ahead.
When you look at your American Express bill, your telephone bill, someone else will have already gone over it before you.
Barbara Dudley's here to talk with us about America's economic global entanglements.
Entanglement has an interesting meaning here. It really means the rich countries get richer and the poor countries get poorer.
All that and more coming up on this hour of Law and Disorder.
Welcome to Law and Disorder. I'm Michael Ratner, President of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
I'm Dahlia Hashad, Arab-Muslim South Asian Advocate for the ACLU.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, Executive Director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Smith, New York City attorney and author. The great civil liberties attorney, Bill Kunstler, saw it coming. The police state is emerging, he warned, bit by bit, step by step, and at some point it'll be irreversible.
Here on Law and Disorder, we four lawyers and activists will strive to be your eyes and ears, your early warning system, your educators, counselors, and advocates. We'll talk about the laws, practices, and procedures that we believe are strangling democracy. We'll be in the courts, in the books, on the streets, and here on the radio with you. We'll be lawyers and activists you'll like.
We're real happy to have with us today two exceptional trial lawyers in New York, Shoshana Bookson, who is the head of the New York State Trial Lawyers Association, that's my organization, and Steve Peskin, who is the delegate from New York to the American Trial Lawyers Association, another organization of mine. I don't claim to be detached in any way here. But this is going to be an objective show, and it's going to be about what the Bush administration calls tort reform. Shoshana, what's wrong with calling something tort reform? They say there's a crisis in medical care. Doctors are quitting. Insurance premiums are too high. People aren't getting care. And it's all the result of people like you and Steve and me, what Bob Doyle said, those trial lawyers and tassel loafers. What's wrong with the conception of tort reform?
Well, thanks for having me here, first of all. It's a pleasure to be here.
Nice to have you.
Thank you. The problem with calling it tort reform is that it makes it seem like there is a crisis when there is no crisis at all. Civil filings of lawsuits are down. They've been going down. Medical malpractice lawsuit filings are down. Payouts are down on medical malpractice cases. So the number one fallacy is that these are out of control awards in an out-of-control system, which is not true. The next thing is that there is some relationship between the tort system and the insurance premiums that are being charged by the insurance companies that regulate this. That is a complete fallacy. They have constructed this argument in such a way to make people believe that if they cap damages, if they restrict people's rights to courthouses, and they limit accountability of doctors and hospitals in medical malpractice cases, that somehow that will eliminate the majority of the costs of insurance for either patients or doctors. And that is simply not true. And the way we know that it is not true is because there are a number of states over the last couple of years who have bought this argument and who have enacted laws with caps. And in those states, the amount of the insurance premiums have actually gone up in contrast to the states like New York, where we have no caps and our premiums have not been going up. They did have an increase last year, but over the last 5 years overall, our premiums have not gone up in any way close to the way it's been going up in the states in which they have enacted caps. Where's the crisis?
Well, what do you say to that, Steve? You've got people saying Arizona, where OBGYN doctors are paying $110,000 a year in premiums, and they're saying, I'm not going to practice medicine anymore, and then they cut to some kid who's no longer getting medical care. What do you say to that?
Michael, thank you again for having me. Shoshana's being extremely diplomatic. She's the president of New York State Trial Lawyers. I'm a past president. There's nothing, no diplomatic immunity is needed. Joseph Goebbels said it best. In World War II, the great lie, the big lie. If you tell a lie loud enough and long enough, people are going to buy into it. And the Bush-Cheney juggernaut are masters at perfecting this lie and carrying it forward, be it weapons of mass destruction or a crisis
in Social Security.
You name it, it's a crisis. If you scream crisis long enough, people are going to get panicked and flock and follow their leader. This is absurd. It's patently absurd. The bottom line here is you have a client that has been catastrophically injured by a tortfeasor, a defendant. The question is, who pays the damages? Does the party who's proven to be responsible, or are the damages spread over the entire population in the form of having welfare pick up the costs of these people's medical care and their pain and suffering? It's kind of sophistry to say to a woman whose husband, the breadwinner, has suffered a catastrophic injury, is a paraplegic, can't move his hands, can't move his legs. When he goes to the toilet, she has to wipe his behind. She and the kids have to feed him, incapable of doing anything. You're going to tell this family, this mother and these children, that $250,000 is all they can get for his pain and suffering and their pain and suffering and watching this once great breadwinner be a vegetable. Oh, yes, we'll also give you the best medical care the state has to offer. Well, you know, God help us when it comes down to that.
What exactly does the Bush administration mean when they say tort reform? What do they really want to do?
They want to eliminate the opportunity for people who are injured to go to courts and seek redress from juries. They would prefer to have administrative proceedings. They would prefer to have arbitrations, any form of non-judicial intervention.
And I think it goes even deeper than that. What they really want to do is to take away the basic rights of every American to have their playing field level against the strongest institutions, medical institutions, hospitals, and by the way, drug companies, which have been tacked on to all of these measures as a side thought, when really those are probably the ones that are driving this whole movement to begin with. And what they really want to do is to provide immunity to corporations and drug companies and hospital corporations all across this country from any mistake that they make. And we know they make mistakes all the time.
How many people do they kill a year in hospitals, Shoshana?
98,000 people a year are killed in hospitals by the studies that were done several years ago, and it's probably gone up since. And I don't have to tell you how many dangerous drugs are out there. Every day of the week we're reading in the newspaper about the newest that is either being taken off the market or being criticized for being on the market because of the millions of people who it is either killing or maiming. What's really going on here, and I'll be a little more blunt about this from the Bush administration's point of view, is their mindset is, how can we take away the threat of a jury of average American people from taking a look at corporate activities that hurt average Americans? How can we take away that threat and protect our largest corporations and our largest Fortune 500 companies? And the best way to do it is exactly what they're doing, which is to take away the rights of these cases being heard in court. And even if they are being heard in court, which very few will be with this type of reform, then the damages are limited to a minimal amount. And when I say minimal, that's the $250,000, because it may sound sound like a lot of money to people who don't think about it in terms of a catastrophically injured individual. But like Steve says, if you're talking about people that need round-the-clock, 24-hour-a-day, 7-day-a-week care, $250,000 for their lifetime, where they can never come back to court ever again, no matter what their costs are, no matter what their expenses are, this is a drop in the bucket. This is lunch money to these corporations.
So when corporations are doing the cost-benefit analysis of making a drug safer or making a product safer, this is now, if tort reform, you know, quote unquote, happens, it's going to be a completely different analysis.
Completely different. We have seen time and again in so many cases of corporations with defective, dangerous products, case after case that has come to court where in the light of the courtroom it's been disclosed that for 2 cents, for 5 cents, for 25 cents, for a dollar, they could be saving lives. And they make corporate decisions in those boardrooms that it is not worth it, and they are willing to not spend that money, and they don't care what the consequences are. And now they're just trying to catch up to, now we're going to know what the consequences are. We're going to limit it. We're going to take away those rights, and we'll never, ever have a fear of any lawsuit coming at us with any injured people, because all we'll ever have to pay, ever, no matter how badly we either kill or maim somebody, is $250,000. It is frightening to me that the administration has been so successful in brainwashing, basically, the American public, that this is a good thing for the American public. And the other part of it that they argue is they're only limiting what they call non-economic damages. This is really important, because what they are always saying is, well, if you can prove economic lost earnings, you'll get every penny of that. But that only helps the injured people who have been proven wage earners. The majority of the people that are hurt in these types of lawsuits are children, elderly, full-time homemakers, non-full-time working people whose lives are actually destroyed. I know these people. I see them every day. And their lives are completely destroyed by these injuries. Their whole dignity is taken away. They have to rely, as Steve says, on a family member to take them to the bathroom. They have to be fed either through a tube or through utensil. These are people that were once productive people in their families and in their communities. And if you want to say that it's okay to limit their non-economic damages, then what you're saying is the value of their existence, the quality of their lives, is minimal.
Thank you. Shoshana Bookson, the president of the New York State Trialers Association. We have also Steve Peskin, who is the delegate from New York to the American Trialers Association. Steve, one question, not on product liability, but on medical malpractice, because they're trying to put caps on that. Just how much medical malpractice is there in the United States? And how much goes unreported and unsued on?
Well, the majority, I believe, of medical malpractice cases or doctor neglect cases go unsued, because the patient is the last person to find out that the doctor's made an error, something called the great white wall of silence. The doctors don't say anything. The worst thing you can hear when you wake up out of anesthesia is whoops. The number of doctors that are sued for malpractice is remarkably small in percentage to the number of doctors actually practicing. And of the doctors sued, the level of recidivism is amazingly high. I don't know what the statistics are. Shoshana, you remember those statistics? I think it's 1% of all of the doctors have 90% of the malpractice claims.
That's been my practical experience.
It's very close to that.
The same people keep popping up as defendants.
Exactly.
Right, and there's a reason for that.
And the rest of the profession is paying for those bad apples, which gets to the issue of the profession's lack of discipline and disciplinary action against their own profession, which is notorious and is national. It's not a state issue. It's a national issue.
I know. We just had a case in my firm out in Nassau County where the pain management doctor stuck a needle full of steroids and air into my client's spinal cord. And we Googled the doctor, and he'd done it to 8 other people. Mm-hmm. And when we started that trial, we had 2 of the people he did it to sitting in the front row That doctor was shaken up, and 2 days later they settled the case. Mm-hmm. A lot of doctors are repeated offenders, and they're not disciplined, and they let them slide.
Mm-hmm. Shoshana mentioned something a while ago about a study that was done that says how dangerous hospitals are. It's surprising. That study was done back in 1992. It was done by the Harvard University School of Medicine. You couldn't have a better credentialed organization.
And published in the New England Journal of Medicine.
And published in the New England Journal of Medicine. And set up by the doctors and the insurance companies because they thought they were going to be vindicated. And what it pointed out is that one of the most dangerous places in the world is to be in a hospital. The majority of people that die in a hospital die of infection. And you want to know something? I can understand that. It's a hospital is where sick people are. Infections attack the sickest people and cause the ultimate injuries to those people. So I'm not surprised at those numbers. But there are certain hospitals where the fatality rate is so high that you would be best lying in the street and having a faith healer come up to you. You have a better chance of surviving. And some of those hospitals, unfortunately, are right here in New York City and are operated by the Health and Hospital Corporation of the City of New York.
That's
so
right.
When the City of New York yells and screams about runaway numbers and big ticket verdicts, it's because they hire the most incompetent doctors. The facilities are the most chaotic. Anybody in the listening audience that has ever gone to an emergency room at a city hospital knows precisely what I'm saying. People can sit there for 3, 4, 5 hours, not be attended to. When they are attended to, it's in the mere perfunctory of manner. And serious situations are not diagnosed and are not treated. And that results in a malpractice lawsuit.
Yeah, and you know what happens when you get to court. And I tell you from my experience like here in Manhattan, if you have a very clear-cut case, they're not going to settle it. When you start to pick a jury, maybe you'll settle it then. But, you know, if you don't have a case that's just a dynamite case, you just have a normal, clear liability case, how many of those cases are lost? Maybe 4 out of 6. Very, very difficult to win a malpractice case. Very difficult.
The statistics are 70% defendant's verdict.
70% of the verdicts are in favor of the defendants at trial.
Yeah.
70%. I mean, 7 out of 10 cases, the doctors or the hospitals win. Only 3 out of 10, very clear minority, are where the patients win.
And if you believe that the insurance companies don't know that and don't roll the dice, then whatever you're smoking, I'd like a toke.
Let me ask a question politically about this. What do you suggest people do? I mean, is it a congressional thing that they have to go to their congresspeople, their senators? Is it a statewide thing? What do people do? Where do they get information?
Okay.
What do they do?
Michael, the best thing for people to do is to contact their local members of Congress or the United States senators, Hillary Rodham Clinton and Charles Schumer.
I was going to say, since the real push and the real action at the moment on these issues is federally and not statewide, where the bills are going to be introduced very soon. They have been in the past few sessions and barely got defeated, but they will be reintroduced very soon in the new session starting in Congress, that people should focus their communications with their federal representatives, both Congress people and United States senators.
And do you have a website where they can get information on this?
www.atla.org, O-R-G.
And ATLA, by the way, is the initials for the American Trial Lawyers Association.
And with that, I want to say long live the American Trial Lawyers Association and long live the New York State Trial Lawyers Association.
Amen to that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Go
Steve Peskin, Shoshana Books, and thank you very much for being on Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Joining us now in the studio is Barbara Dudley, former president of the National Lawyers Guild and also former executive director of Greenpeace USA. Welcome, Barbara.
Thank you, Heidi.
Hi. With all those formers, Barbara, what are you actually doing now?
What I'm doing now, let's see. I'm teaching at Portland State University. I teach political science. I'm working here with Military Law Task Force on a few cases, stop-loss cases, and I'm working with the State Federation of Labor.
Barbara, since I've known you for the last 20 years, you've been consistently a troublemaker. Remember, I saw you last in Birmingham, Alabama, for the National Lawyers Guild Convention, and you gave such a fine speech. That's why we all wanted you on the show. Can you tell us in a nutshell what you told us then? If you give us an idea of what your research has showed on the global economic situation, I think there's a tie-in between that and the inclination of this country to constantly break national, international law.
Well, actually, what the panel that I was part of when I gave that speech in Birmingham was about sort of the stretch of empire in general. And I was trying to relate the economic stretch to the military stretch, because obviously they're very interrelated, and we tend, even on the left, I think, to separate them a lot. And I think what we can expect is very interesting on the economic front in the coming year. I mean, it's probably more interesting in some ways than what we can expect militarily, because it's less predictable. What is the big picture is about the trade agreements that are already in force and that are coming into consideration by Congress. One of the things that has happened that I think the left has lost track of is the WTO went into effect in 1995. And since then has become an object, as we all know, of many protesters and a lot of resistance. But what we don't know is that it has become an instrument for the United States economic policy to be seriously challenged by developing countries. And as a result, what's happening is that many conservatives in Congress, along with the one or two progressives in Congress, are actually talking about pulling the U.S. out of the WTO, because the WTO has ruled against the United States in a few cases. And that, as you know, since we won't submit to the International Criminal Court, we'll be damned if we're going to submit to an International Economic Court either. And that's what the WTO is on some level. The other thing that's going on is because the U.S. is unwilling to give up its position of privilege, specifically around agricultural issues, but many other issues as well, and insisting that we can continue subsidizing our farmers to the tune of $80 billion in the last farm bill, but that developing countries cannot subsidize their farmers because they can't give direct subsidies. What they do instead is do import protections, and that was made illegal by the WTO, whereas our form of direct welfare to rich farmers is not made illegal by the WTO. Well, the developing countries are rebelling against this, led by Brazil and a few other key countries. They're basically refusing to go along with other aspects of the WTO until the U.S. brings its reality into line with its rhetoric. So that all of that means that this is going to be a year of tremendous, tremendous upheaval in the world of so-called free trade.
You know, Barbara, yeah, if the economy here does go into the tank, and I do agree with you, I think that it's only a matter of time. I think that they're gearing up now for that with the kind of police state legislation that they've put through ever since 9/11, before 9/11, but ever since also.
They certainly are in a position to repress anybody and anything that they want to repress at this stage of the game. I mean, the only thing that's between them and us is a very few friendly faces in Congress who might find that somewhat appalling, and the remaining few faces in the judiciary who still believe in the Constitution, but they're few and far between.
I want to go back, Barbara, for a second to the WTO stuff. Mm-hmm. I have two sorts of questions. One is, when you talk about subsidies that we're giving to our, like, American cotton farmers and others, how much harm does that actually cause in undeveloped countries to people? And if we change that, would there be a change in poverty rate, et cetera, in those countries?
Well, that's the big debate. And, in fact, because Oxfam and others who've been historically part of the anti-WTO contingent have said that is the way out of poverty for the developing countries, is for the U.S. and Europe to drop their agricultural subsidies, because what the developing countries have to export are agricultural commodities. But there are plenty of activists in developing countries who would say that's absolutely the wrong approach. And I think it's a serious debate. I don't think there's an easy answer on either side. because what the people who would say that's not the way out of poverty would argue that an export platform for monocropping, you know, in a developing country, developing just crops for export, leads to a dependency on the economy of the rich world that is unhealthy, and that what developing countries ought to be doing is to be moving towards self-sufficiency. And the most interesting development, actually, Michael, in the world these days is the sort of alliance that's being built between China and Brazil and Mexico and South Africa, who are seeing themselves as sort of the big brothers, perhaps in the bad sense of the word, as well as the good, toward the least developed countries, and starting to talk about trade regimes that could actually be free trade agreements, or trade agreements, not free trade agreements in the sense that we think of them, but trade agreements amongst developing countries, or regional trade agreements that exclude the U.S. and exclude Europe. And that's starting to happen more and more. Now, one can really question whether, you know, one should trust the Chinese, or even trust the Brazilians for that matter, because despite the fact that they have a progressive government, they are a huge economy that's very dependent on agricultural exports themselves. But it is a positive in the sense that it's breaking the bond that the Europeans and primarily the United States has with these developing countries, the economic bonds, and giving them alternative ways of paths of development that they can think about.
Yeah, no, I have seen the Chinese making huge gains, and certainly in terms of their relationships with countries in South America,
absolutely,
as well as the Caribbean. I think that's become a bigger and bigger issue for the United States. Back on the WTO for a second, I know you've described it pretty well, what's going on. The question, if I look going forward for the year for activists, what kinds of pathways are there for us? What kind of alternatives? What kinds of things should we be looking to do? What are some of the goals in the next year?
Well, one of the most specific and immediate things that's going to be coming up is going to be a vote in Congress to approve the Central America Free Trade Agreement. And that should and honestly could be opposed. I think that there is a real possibility of an alliance being made in Congress that would give us a real majority to destroy CAFTA and bring it down. And if that happens, you're going to see a snowball effect where I think the free trade area of the Americas, the one that encompasses all of North and South America and Central America except Cuba, as they will always say, that the free trade area of the Americas is really, really on the ropes itself. And if CAFTA goes down, the FTAA is going to go down, and that will start a momentum that I think will blow up these trade agreements altogether. I think NAFTA is under incredible pressure right now. There's a lawsuit being filed in Canada that may have some chance of success, but mostly NAFTA is becoming sort of a bête noire for the states, a state-by-state thing of the states that have a lot of trade with either Canada or Mexico. They're starting to resist a lot of the terms of NAFTA that allow corporations to sue the government directly and those sorts of things. So this whole regime could easily fall. And if the right-wingers join forces with the progressives to pull out of the WTO, we have like a blank slate then. We start all over again. And I think that the possibilities of coming up with a better trade regime are really strong, because you have countries like Brazil that have become very wise in the ways of trade negotiations now and are standing up for their interests and the interests of the developing world.
Barbara, one last thing. What kind of places can people go to for more information? What are some websites? What are some organizations that they can look at?
Well, WTOwatch.org is the place to go, or TradeObservatory.org are the places to go for as much information as anybody could possibly digest on these things. The Citizens Trade Campaign is still alive and well and is the principal coordinator of the WTO activities. The trade unions, I know the State Fed here is in the leadership on trade work, and I assume that's true in most other states. I can't vouch for New York, though. Your State Fed sometimes leaves something to be desired. So But I think in general, to just go to Citizens Trade Campaign, and the websites are WTO Watch or Trade Observatory.
Thanks, Barbara. This is Michael Smith, Michael Ratner, Hyde Bogosian, Dahlia Shad. We're all very grateful you're on the show. It's nice to talk to you, and you have a good year. Make some trouble.
Yes, and I'm going to be in New York in March. I'll see you then.
Well, come back on the show.
Thanks, Barbara.
Bye, Barbara. Bye.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
We just spoke with activist Barbara Dudley, former president of the National Lawyers Guild and former executive director of Greenpeace. Joining us now to talk about the national security state is Professor Michael Avery, president of the National Lawyers Guild and constitutional law professor at Suffolk Law School in Boston. Welcome, Michael, to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. It's nice to be with you.
Hi, Michael. It's Michael Smith. You know, when last I saw you was in Birmingham, Alabama at the National Lawyers Guild convention. You gave such a good talk there, and we're grateful to have you on the air. We wanted to ask you if you might recap for us what you said then about the real degeneration in democratic rights in this country and what you think we can expect in the coming year.
Well, you know, I think most Americans have blithely assumed that our experiment in constitutional democracy would just go on forever. But I'm afraid that we're going to follow the path of most regimes and certainly all empires, and that we're now looking at the demise of our constitutional democracy and the creation in America of a national security state.
And what do you mean by that?
What I mean by a national security state is one in which the executive department is really running the government, where we've eliminated much of the protection that is afforded by separation of powers, where there's little or no judicial review of principal decisions that are made by the executive department, particularly those relating to security, where we have a visible increase in uniform security in our society, less accountability for law enforcement, spying on targeted individuals and groups, and increased surveillance of the citizenry generally, and a society that's organized around a national mission that, at least on its face, claims it has something to do with protecting our security.
Unhappily, I totally agree with you. It's been before, but especially since 9/11, it's just, you know, shocking, the boldness and the aggressiveness that they've shown in unfolding that agenda. Just recently, with the latest law they've passed on the Homeland Security Act, I think they've taken giant steps in the wrong direction. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Let's just consider one example of what the government is now able to do, which is the use of national security letters by the government. This is something that has received much less attention in the public press than it deserves. There's a lot of concern about the ability of the government to find out what library books you're reading and so on and so forth. But actually, much more important than that is the fact that the FBI now has the power, under the Patriot Act and the Homeland Security Act, to send letters to those institutions in society that keep many of our most private records, financial institutions, medical providers, credit agencies, banks, and the like. And to get information about us from these different institutions without any subpoena, without any court review, with no opportunity for those of us whose records are collected in this way to challenge what's happening. And in fact, all this takes place without the knowledge of the people whose records are being gathered, because it's a felony for anybody who receives one of these national security letters from the government to inform the person whose records are being collected. Now, this really stands a lot of our constitutional protections on their heads. In the ordinary course, in order to get private information about a person, the government has to go first to a court and convince a judge that there's sufficient reason, some sufficient governmental interest, usually having to do with some proof that the person's involved in criminal activity, some sufficient reason to invade that person's privacy. But what we see under the Patriot Act and under the Homeland Security Act is an ability by the government to invade in a dragnet fashion the privacy of thousands and millions of Americans with no judicial review whatsoever.
And no one knows this is happening for the most part.
For the most part, nobody knows what they're doing. We only learned a little bit about it last year because in a Freedom of Information Act lawsuit that the ACLU filed, the government turned over some information about what it had been doing. I'm quite certain only the tip of the iceberg. But even from that tip of the iceberg, we could see that the records they were gathering are staggering. Just to give you an example, anybody who visited Las Vegas during the last 2 weeks of the last calendar year had their records, their hotel records, their flight records, their rental car records, all were collected by the government. Everybody who visited Las Vegas during that period of time, their records were swept up in this dragnet search. That's a staggering idea.
Why, Michael?
Why, yeah.
Evidently, the government had some information, we don't even know what it was, that something may have been happening in Las Vegas during that period of time that the government claimed was related to national security, and all they have to do is have the thinnest of reasons for that, and then instead of focusing the investigation on a particular person or a particular place, they can conduct this type of dragnet investigation.
At Las Vegas Tourism Bureau this past year has been doing an advertising campaign with the slogan, "What happens in Vegas stays in Vegas."
That's funny. Mike, we've got Michael Avery, president of the National Lawyers Guild, on the line. Michael, comment for us, will you, on the Homeland Security Act's provision to make a unified national driver's license and also a unified national birth certificate. What's the meaning of that?
Well, you know, it's interesting. If we go back to 1935, when the Social Security Act was adopted, and when Americans were assigned a Social Security number, there was a huge debate in Congress at that time about whether that Social Security number would become a universal identification number. And in fact, written into the law was the notion that the use of the Social Security number would have to be limited. And then, as recently as 1968, when the Privacy Act was passed, it was underlined that government agencies are not allowed to use the Social Security number as a universal identification number. What we have now...
But Michael, on that, how come everybody does, though? I knew about that law, but every time I get a form of any sort, it ask me for my Social Security number.
Well, first of all, the law doesn't apply to private information gatherers, but just to the government. And secondly, most government agencies ignore it. So that has pretty much been thrown out the window. But I mention it to show that Americans have always been suspicious and have always tried to protect themselves from some form of internal passport control in this country. Now, the questions you asked about the driver's license and so on are clear steps toward adopting some type of internal passport. And if you think about it, the functions of an internal passport are already being performed when you go to the airport and you have to show some state-issued identification, usually your driver's license, to get on the airplane. They even have that on Amtrak now. When you go to pick up your ticket, you're supposed to show your identification. It's going to be that when you check into a hotel or when you use public services, you'll have to show that identification. So that the government's ability to track us, to track all of our movements all the time, has expanded hugely. And not satisfied with that, not satisfied with the idea of making people show identification, there are now more and more proposals for the installation of global tracking devices, GPS, global positioning
system.
These GPS devices are being installed on automobiles, cell phones. There are even some medical providers who are urging parents to install them under their children's skin so that if the children are kidnapped, they can be found.
Like they do for pets now.
Yeah, only they're going to do it for people. And so we are going to have virtually no ability to remain anonymous. And the significance of that is that anonymity is very important to dissent. Anonymity is very important to giving people the sense of freedom and the confidence that they can dissent from their government's policies, that they can protest, that they can raise questions about what's happening in their country without losing their job, without being subjected to a variety of penalties. But we are at serious risk of losing that anonymity completely.
Michael, can you give any suggestions for listeners about what kinds of things we can do on a day-to-day level to fight back?
Well, I think, first of all, people have to inform themselves about what's happening. And secondly, I think people have to begin to insist at every opportunity that they have that the terrorism concern that is fueling all of this is grossly overblown. I saw that yesterday Richard Goldstone, who was the first chief prosecutor at the war crimes tribunals for the former Yugoslavia and Rwanda, came out and made a statement that the United States terror war is a complete overreaction. People need to do something to restore their confidence in our safety in this country. The administration has succeeded in turning us into a nation of frightened sheep, and we need to, we need to take back ownership of our own society.
So how do you do it, Michael?
Well, I think people have to organize. I think people have to go to the Democratic politicians in this country who have been running, with rare exceptions. Barbara Boxer comes to mind for standing up to Condoleezza Rice. But with rare exceptions like that, the Democrats have been running away from the Constitution and away from our civil liberties almost as fast as the Republicans. We have to go to our elected officials, whether on a local level, like the Bill of Rights Defense Committee does, where people have passed these local resolutions against the Patriot Act, or on a national level, to our senators and congressmen. We have to let people know that they have to fight back against.
Michael, our producer just passed us a note, and I want to ask you this, saying that there's a sophisticated tracking system embedded in U.S. currency. Have you heard about that?
I have not.
Have you heard about their putting biometrics on driver's license and birth certificates?
I have heard that. Yes, I have heard that.
Is that a proposal, or is that a fact, or is that a fantasy? What have you heard?
I don't know whether that's been instituted or not.
By biometrics, you mean a way of identifying the person whose card that is through that person's makeup or biology? Is that the idea?
Yeah. They put your DNA. Encode your DNA on your driver's license.
You did hear the one I read, I'm sure, the other day, Michael, that for getting through the lines rapidly when you're leaving the country or entering the country, you can have your iris scanned and do iris scans, and they're going to test this at Kennedy. And then after you have your iris scanned and they identify you like that, you also, to get the special card, you get interviewed by someone from Homeland Security, and then you can get the special
traveler.
Right, and then you the trusted traveler, and then you can go right in and out. I don't think that, I won't speak for everybody here, But I'm sure that some of the people on this program won't make it through the iris scan.
Well, you know, Michael, what they're creating with some of these things is a two-tier society. And we already have that. I read an article in the paper yesterday about Hartford, Vermont. Hartford, Vermont, which is 100 miles from the Canadian border, has a checkpoint that you have to go through. And the people of color in that community call it the White Pass checkpoint or something, because if you're white, you sail right through. And if you're African-American, or if you appear to be Muslim or Arab or South Asian, you don't sail right through.
It's exactly like what happened up at Buffalo when Muslims who attended a conference in Toronto were trying to get back into the country. Many of them who live right there on the border in the United States, all of whom had U.S. passports, were held for 6-7 hours while their identity was checked, while they were fingerprinted, while they were photographed. And they watched white people sail straight through the border.
Well, you know, people ask about many of these things that we've been talking about this morning. They say, what's the danger? What's the problem with all of this? But the underlying problems, you know, it's not privacy for privacy's sake, although that's important. But the underlying problems are the elimination of free speech, the right to dissent, and the creation of a caste society where we have people who are much worse off than others because of their ethnic background.
Michael, this is chilling, really, what you've said.
Well, I think people need to wake up, and we need to make some demands on people in this country with some power to get in the way of what's happening.
Michael Avery, thank you very much. We've come to the end of the segment, but we certainly appreciate Michael Avery, head of the National Lawyers Guild, being on Law and Disorder. Thanks, Michael.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Really terrific interview, Michael.
Bye, Michael.
Bye.
Today on Law and Disorder, we're pleased to have with us Avi Cover. Avi is a lawyer who works at Human Rights First, and for a number of weeks now has been writing about, set up their website, and done amazing work around Alberto Gonzalez, the president's nominee to be the Attorney General of the United States. Welcome to Law and Disorder, Avi.
Thanks for having me, Michael.
So, Avi, tell us a little bit about what you've been doing at Human Rights First on this. It is one of the great websites, I think, on Gonzalez.
Sure, absolutely. Well, I think the primary goal was to really connect the dots on the work of Alberto Gonzalez. And that work was essentially playing a critical role in creating the architecture of the torture policy that is the Bush administration's. That involved really a lot of the stuff was out there, but I think just a lot of people just hadn't, you know, essentially connected the dots. He oversaw the creation and drafting and dissemination of what's now known as the torture memo. This is J.S. Bybee's August 1st, 2002 memo, which famously says that, you know, you haven't committed torture unless the pain is equivalent to that associated with organ failure or death. Now, of course, what he has always said prior to these hearings, and now his likely confirmation as Attorney General, was that this was just an abstract exercise. These were academic questions. But of course, we know that's not true. The very analysis that was there in the torture memo shows up in the working group report, which was the military's, the Pentagon's, main legal analysis for detention policy that was going to be implemented in Guantanamo and Afghanistan. And of course, through either illicit and explicit motives by the Bush administration or some happenstance, this very same analysis found its way into Iraq. And so then we have the pictures and images from Abu Ghraib. So his role is something that he can't diminish no matter what the administration wants to do, no matter what his supporters want to do. He is emblematic and really, you know, one of the decisive figures in what we're seeing worldwide.
One of the things that I noticed, as you said, it was torture being very narrowly defined to basically be organ failure or near death, really. And under that definition, even those pictures of Abu Ghraib that we saw, those horrendous pictures, might not or would not, under his definition in that memo, constitute torture. Is that right?
That's absolutely right. And what's remarkable is the doublespeak that both he engages in and the entire administration, which, of course, they condemn everything that we see at Abu Ghraib. That is deplorable. It's despicable. We abhor that. But You know, and then we craft this very detailed, precise, narrow definition of torture so that that wouldn't meet that definition. You're exactly right. What it invites, of course, is another can of worms, which they've been playing very slippery with, which is the issue of cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment. This is also, of course, prohibited by treaties that we are party to. It's prohibited in the Geneva Convention. It's prohibited in the Convention Against Torture, which is also named not just the Convention Against Torture, but also against cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment. And they have played very slippery with that definition to basically read it a meaningless prohibition on any interrogations that are done on non-citizens outside of the United States, which is, of course, basically what the detention policy is of the United States.
It was interesting at the hearing, I think a couple of the senators, they didn't do great at the hearing, but a couple of them tried to pin him down on whether he agreed with the narrow definition at the time it was written. And at the end of the day, he had to say, well, I didn't agree with all the analysis, but I did agree with the conclusions of the famous memo that we're speaking of that narrowed the definition of torture. I think that's correct. Is that right?
That's exactly right. I mean, he, you know, numerous times tried to avoid the question. You're right. But in the end, and his defense was really just pathetic. I mean, it was essentially that, well, that's the Department of Justice opinion. That's the opinion of the Office of Legal Counsel, and I have to accept that. Well, one has to wonder, what is his role as White House counsel? He has to accept it. What's the point of his position? I mean, he describes being in at all these meetings and essentially being an observer, a silent fly on the wall. It's just an absolute indefensible defense. You know, he said, I don't recall a dozen times during the hearing in terms of what his role was. I mean, the greatest thing, of course, is that he doesn't remember whether he requested the Bybee memo to be written. Well, the Bybee memo opens with these words: you have requested us to analyze the interrogation procedures to be used. I mean, it's just...
He doesn't recall that, and he didn't recall there was a meeting, or at least a couple of meetings maybe you're more familiar with than I am, where they sat around, maybe a justice or somewhere, discussing various techniques like waterboarding, where you push people underwater or put a towel around them and try and make them drown. And he said he doesn't remember, I think, this what he was discussed or what was approved. This is like the most significant memo probably to come out of his department or out of justice. And these techniques are obviously of the highest level looking at in terms of the CIA. And he says he doesn't remember. I think he's lying.
You know, you can choose. Either he's a liar, either he's, you know, engaging in illicit practices, or he's not intelligent. And, you know,
right, that was my conclusion. Either this is the most ignorant guy we've had up there in a long time, or he's lying. What I couldn't understand about the Geneva issue is on the issue of abuse and torture and cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment. Even if the administration somehow is right, which I don't think they are, there's still all these other laws that prohibit abuse, torture, inhumane treatment, cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment. So in some way, it was a red herring in terms of this issue.
I think that's right. But what it at least did, though, was, you know, if there was any entity, and Lindsey Graham's questioning at the hearing sort of confirmed that, is that the military does take the Geneva Conventions very seriously. And the laws that are impressed upon the military, because you're dealing with obviously this very violent and innately chaotic situation. And what's fascinating is you can read military individuals, even when the president's order came down that Geneva didn't apply, they tried to apply it. They were resisting this. But, you know, this, of course, bred a level of ambiguity. It bred a level of confusion, which is exactly what Colin Powell and other military figures had predicted.
Avi, why all of a sudden in 2004 and 2005 are these people reversing what we understood to be human rights law that's evolved over centuries? What's going on?
I mean, first and foremost, and they will say this, and this was Gonzalez's line from the very beginning, that the war on terrorism, you know, renders the Geneva Conventions obsolete, or certain provisions of it obsolete, certain provisions of it quaint. They view 9/11 as a shock to the international legal system, and they view a lot of, you know, those provisions as something from a bygone era. You know, the Geneva Conventions, they continue to say they're of 1949, that we need to reassess, that this is a different kind of enemy. In addition to that, you have an administration in place that has always sought a powerful executive. You know, you're seeing a lot of the similar arguments that the Reagan administration brought out. I mean, the sort of the resonance and similarity with things that we saw in the early 80s with the Contras and in El Salvador is quite telling and frightening. Bush is assembling a new cabinet where you're going to have a bunch of yes people. I mean, which is of course a frightening notion that he didn't before. But you know, to the degree that you could see, and we can see in some of the memos that at least Powell was a voice of some dissent. We're seeing that's going to no longer be the case. I mean, if there's anything, Gonzalez is loyal to a great fault to the president. I mean, he was there in Texas with him. There's, you know, despicable things with the death penalty memos and various aspects there. You know, Rice is another loyal figure. Chertoff played an integral role in the Ashcroft administration. Now you're going to have all these people on top. So you're seeing people who played this critical role in the infrastructure of the policies that have been employed, and now they're on top.
Now, what does it mean that we have this man whose fingerprints are all over international torture? as our Attorney General?
I mean, it's an embarrassment. I mean, I don't know how, and you know, and he writes in his answers to some of the senator's questions with a straight face that, you know, obviously people who violate the Geneva Convention should be prosecuted. I mean, it's very hard to uphold the rule of law and shout that everything needs to be respected and condemn other countries' practices of torture and interrogation and cruel and inhuman and degrading treatment and yet be perpetrators ourselves.
A lot of people spent a good deal of time painting Ashcroft as kind of the devil of this administration. And Gonzalez doesn't look too good, but he doesn't come with that same kind of taint. Do you think he's as bad or worse than Ashcroft?
I don't see how the United States can be a country that commits acts of torture and cruel, inhuman, degrading treatment and defends it. And we're looking at one of the principal defenders of it. So, you know, compared to Ashcroft, you know, Ashcroft at least actually condemned some of these steps that Gonzalez had advocated. They each are probably pretty despicable in each individual's own right.
Avi Cover from Human Rights First, thanks for joining us on Law and Disorder.
Thank you, Avi.
Thank you,
great
Avi.
To have
thanks
you.
For having me.
Southern man, you better keep your head.
That's it for this week's Law and Disorder. Thanks to Steve Peskin, Shoshana Bookson, Avi Cover, Barbara Dudley, and Michael Avery. Law and Disorder is produced by Jeff Brady. Thanks from me, Dahlia Hashad, and all of us here in Law and Disorder. We look forward to being with you again on Monday the 21st at 10 a.m. right after Democracy Now! Southern man, keep your head.